citizens of America are now joined in a great national effort to rebuild our country and restore its promise for all of our people. For too long, a small group in our nation's capital has reaped the rewards of government while the people have borne the cost. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer. We assembled here today are issuing a new decree to be heard in every city, in every foreign capital, and in every hall of power. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first. The time for empty talk is over. Now arrives the hour of action. Do not allow anyone to tell you that it cannot be done. No challenge can match the heart and fight and spirit of America. We will not fail. Our country will thrive and prosper again.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it's a historical day as President-elect Donald Trump assumes the office of presidency to become the 45th president of the United States. The market seems to like it. At the time we're doing this broadcast, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 103 points, the S&P's up 10. We're still trying to fight back and get to that 20,000 level. The one good thing, interest rates have come back. But overall, it has been a mixed market these last 5 days. The Dow has lost just a quarter of a point for the week. We don't know how that'll end up by the end of the day. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Tom McClellan will be joining us. He's very positive, but he says, you know what? Markets tend to rally right after election, and then after inauguration, we get a correction. And according to Tom, by the end of the month, he tends to go short. Right now, he's long the market. You want to hear why and what he thinks will happen by the end of the year. He's very positive. Also joining me on the program will be Dan Steffens. He'll be here talking about energy. Dan's pretty bullish on oil. He sees the OPEC production cuts following through, almost 1.8 million barrels, which will start to balance the market. He sees $60 oil, and believe it or not, a major brokerage firm is talking about $75 oil. What would that mean for the markets? He'll be here to tell us why he feels that. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be joining us in Hour 1, talking about what moved the markets this week. All of this coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler, and this is probably our most favoriter show in the year.
Is that a new word?
No, it's just a misuse of an old one.
Okay.
Our most favoriter show, second of a two-part forecast, which we always do at the beginning of the year. First week, we always look at the consensus out there and some people who are thinking outside the box. And then part two, which is today, what are our forecasts for the coming year, especially in the light of the new presidential administration. We'll also do a review of the major numbers as President Obama came into office and as he left, and then look at the challenges moving forward that are going to face the current administration and the markets and the economy in the years to come, particularly in 2017. All of that today here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And Ryan Poplava, there were times I doubted we'd ever reach this day, the day of inauguration. It's been a long slugfest for both parties, as a matter of fact. Welcome back. We usher in a new regime change in Washington, D.C., with the stock market ever watchful of the change in power. How are you reading things? What's your interpretation of the stock market's movement here? Because, as I understood, it wasn't the plan to buy the election and sell the inauguration by traders.
Yeah, I think a lot of the trading desks talked about, you know, wait and see for the inauguration day if there was an opportunity to sell. And I know we rallied on Friday, in fact, as a result of the inauguration. And now during Trump's speech, he did have some protectionist kind of comments that we did see a little bit of a dip intraday. But overall, market came roaring back, saw maybe unity as the main subject there that could potentially really propel this nation to really see some positive changes, as long as we see, both parties come work together and compromise. But, largely, the S&P's been flat since December 13th. Most of the election rally happened very quickly over a month, and that's very typical of this market. Information, once it's received, is enacted upon very quickly by algorithms, by program traders, by the market itself, and just on momentum. And then we have this sort of wait-and-see approach right now to Trump and his plans to deregulate, reform taxes, and invest in infrastructure. Those are things, they're not going to happen day one, of any presidency. Those are huge topics that take acts of Congress and, like I said, compromise to see form and come to fruition. But, most of the market moving kind of talks related to those subjects actually happened, John, over last weekend in an interview with Trump, in which he basically said the current GOP border tax is too complicated and that his replacement plan for Obamacare has the goal of providing insurance for everybody. So those were kind of two issues that related to those big three things, tax reform, deregulation, Obamacare, that basically might be diverging a little bit from the GOP and where there might be room for some needed negotiation. So the stock market dropped on Monday as a result of those comments. Since we haven't really heard too much on how Trump's ideas really differ from the GOP, except for on a certain elements of the tax plans with corporate tax reform. But true to form, some buyers stepped in on Monday morning and stocks were largely unchanged this week with a decent release of a number of economic numbers throughout the week. Decent earnings results so far. Financials were fairly strong. However, some of the reaction to those earnings weren't revolutionary. We didn't see huge moves to the upside in financials. A lot of the rally has already happened in those. So essentially the market's just kind of digesting, a lot of these returns, a lot of these earnings. But yeah, like I said, the economics have been good. New president sworn in, that didn't make the same radical statement that many thought he might, given, his typical demeanor and the speeches that he had on the campaign trail and how very verbose he was on many topics. I see somebody that's kind of settling in here, and maybe for the respect of the institution, and maybe respect for the outgoing Obamas and his legacy. But you see, like I said, he's interested in seeing insurance for all with Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act. So I think we may finally have a president that has strong feelings, yes, to help Americans, but also who will do it trying to work with both sides of the aisle. And, lucky for him, he's already got a leg up with his party in control of both branches.
You know what I found interesting today in watching this? You ever remember the Warner Brothers cartoon where the sheepdog and the coyote would show up at the same time and they'd punch a clock and good morning, Sam. Good morning, Hal. And then they'd go out and they'd fight all day. And at the end, they'd go, good night, Sam. Good night, Hal. As they punch out, right? We'll do it again tomorrow. In watching them all sweet talk today, I thought, boy, they said pretty nasty things about each other from time to time.
On the campaign trail.
Yeah, on the campaign trail. And then come back together and say blah, blah, blah. And they're all smiles and the whole bit. So I don't know if I could actually do that anyway. Okay. So politically, investors are going to continue to support stocks with the possibility of Trump plans moving forward on those big three subjects of tax reform, deregulation, and infrastructure spending. Of course, there are jitters in Washington, too, because Trump is threatening to cut the workforce by 20%. And if you go back and remember the J. Peter Grace Commission back in early 1990s, the study showed that you could cut out 50% of the workforce and we wouldn't notice any difference because there's so much bloat and corruption that's in the structure itself. But all of that aside, anyway, so it's tax reform, deregulation, and infrastructure spending. Anything else you think could hurt this rally and maybe cause a downward correction?
I think the only thing right now outside of the fiscal changes that are being planned is maybe a change in the economic data signaling a slowdown. Valuations are pretty stretched right now. So I think with valuations being stretched, they're going to be vulnerable to any kind of hiccup in that kind of data, any kind of hiccup in earnings data, monetary policy maybe being too aggressive at removing accommodation. We did hear from Yellen this week. She did a speech, and then we've got the Fed next week. You know, valuations, like I said, they're high, but they're not extreme. We only just saw the end of the earnings recession that had been going on for many quarters in the third quarter. And just now, we're going to kick off the fourth quarter earnings season really in earnest next week. The ones that have spearheaded this so far have been the financials. Like I said, they've been strong. Not a very good response from investors to those earnings. It's been kind of, you know, like I said, digesting this rally. I think the only thing that might derail the rally at any moment is always, you know, just the chance of a rogue wave event that could really affect things. And if something like that ever happened, you know, I'm going to report it here. But so far, there's nothing in my view that could really, really derail this rally so far. In fact, you know, we are going through a correction. You know, and technical analysts would say, John, that we're going through a running collection, a sideways correction. And so that's, you know, happening right now. We're digesting this rally. But if valuations get too stretched because of euphoria, or we see monetary policy really begin to act at odds with Trump aggressively raising interest rates, I think that's the only thing that could hurt this business cycle so far. And I don't see that in the near term. Eventually we'll get there, but I don't think we're there yet. I think we're in the sweet spot. The market is up 7% since the elections, and we're kind of currently going through, like I said, you know, just a running correction. We're working off all those momentum indicators and setting up towards maybe some moving averages coming up and supporting the short term. Bulls are waiting for the next catalyst, however, to break out higher or fold if, like I said, you know, a rogue wave hits or we get some really nasty comments on the protectionist front. Like I said, and, you know, at one point this week, I think China iterated that they would retaliate with aggressive border tax and tariffs type of a situation, and or any kind of movement by our military, I guess, over their sovereignty in the sea. So that's, I think, the only thing that could really, really hurt things in the near term, but nothing in the foreseeable future right now.
Yeah, and you have to remember, too, that this is beginning the period of what I call the great reneging, and that is when candidates say, well, yes, we said all of those things, but yep, here's the real world. And the beauty of our system is that the president doesn't make the decisions alone as a dictator. He has to build a coalition in Congress in order to get things through. And that sort of damps a lot of that down. And honestly, you know, I think people are misunderstanding Donald Trump as I've watched him over these 24 months. And when he gets into negotiating session, he tends to be nuts and bolts, pretty direct. What are we going to do? We're going to work this out. Here's the outcome. Now, how do we get there and keep everybody happy? You know, but he basically does it. So I think people are going to be a little surprised because I think they are not underestimating him so much. Although I think some of the media are, to be honest with you, very much like they underestimated Ronald Reagan. I watched the very same thing happen there, but they're also misestimating him, if that makes a sense. And we'll see whether that plays out. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, I could be totally wrong in this thing. Okay. Going back to the week. Economic data points, any of those that really got you intriguedly interested?
Well, we did start to see the January numbers, and I'll go into that in a second. I think the only thing that really, it didn't move the markets, but it just continues to reiterate that the Fed's probably on the right path, was the consumer price index, which was up, I think it was up 0.3%, if I remember, month over month. But the year over year was right around 2.2%. And that's near, you know, the Fed target. And that number continues to have a steady rise to it and nothing alarming to it, just a steady rise. And like I said, that really supports the Fed continue to remove accommodation. And we'll likely continue to see some rate hikes this year, nowhere near what we saw last year with just a huge fall off in January. Manufacturing really fell off. And then we had some currency issues with China, capital leaving, and what that did to the financial markets was enough to cause the Fed to pause for a very long time. The January numbers, like I said, they're looking good. The Empire Manufacturing Index did come down to 6.5 from 9 in December, but anything above zero is an expansionary number, and mainly it was the new orders tapering off that had that result. However, the Philadelphia Fed Index rose to 23.6 from 19.7, so a bit of an acceleration there in that region. Both are in, like I said, expansionary territory for their respective indicators, and then we got housing. housing starts were up about 11.3% in December, not due to single family homes, mainly was due to multi-family units, apartments. So that's what was moving that, you know, largely those areas we thought would really be hurt hard by interest rates jumping as much as they did in the fourth quarter. And as a result of better economics and the expectation that the Fed was going to go. So jobs continue to look good. As well, with the unemployment claims was down to 234,000. That was down 15,000. Again, those are numbers that are near, you know, just record areas. And then finally, earnings. So not necessarily economic news, but earnings have been released. It's been a mixed bag. We did get some big numbers from IBM. GE wasn't that great. Kind of mixed bag. Financials, like I said, have been strong. But the responses to those earnings, they're digesting. But we will get a big kickoff next week. And I'm looking forward to see where things are going on with some of the industrials as a result of, you know, some of these manufacturing numbers doing well. The dollar, you know, has been going up, and that's a possible problem for these multinational corporations. However, the dollar's been going sideways recently. There were some comments about Brexit by the prime minister there, was talking about essentially what she envisioned it might look like for the nation. And she said basically it would take some time and it would be done in phases. And that brought some strength to the pound. And we saw some strength in the euro as well this week, in that we saw a little drop in the dollar. So overall, you know, data points were strong this week for economics. Earnings have been good so far as well. A mixed bag for some of the other multinationals and large companies that we saw later in the week. Big week ahead, though, in earnings. So I'm looking forward to addressing some of those earnings results next week.
Yeah, and overall, I mean, we had a lot of hoopla because politically we were headed toward the inauguration this week. But overall, it was fairly quiet for stocks. The dollar index continues to hold above 100, it's near 14-year highs. Commodities have benefited to a weak dollar this week, but they, you know, they don't seem to be going anywhere. They're trading in a pretty narrow range over the last couple of weeks. So I guess, Ryan, what we're going to do is watch and see what Washington has for us over the next few weeks. If Mr. Trump plans to make any big statements, I have a feeling things are going to move pretty fast. But it seems maybe he's settling into the role a bit better, because we don't know. I mean, all during Inauguration Day, you know how they start to look more and more tired, you know, because they've been running since 5 a.m. or something like that.
Yeah, his last end of the day speech, he said, we're just going to cut this short. And I think it was like,
right, this is, I can't deal with any of this. And then they have these balls to go to at night. And then I think what they probably want to do the next day is just crash, like, leave me alone, yeah. You know. So it seems like maybe he's settling into the role just a bit better than the media portrayed that he would. Like I said, I think they are misestimating him in certain areas, and I have reasons for believing that, but we don't need to go into it here. By the way, Jim wrote an article this week, and I want you to talk about that. We'll be talking about it on The Big Picture.
Yeah, actually, he did. A great article. There were actually two pieces that I really enjoyed reading this week. That was one of them. I think he called it The Inheritance, which it kind of sets the tone for what Trump's walking into, taking a look at, you know, what Obama had walked into with coming out in the midst of a recession, where monetary policy stance was back then, extremely easy. And now, you know, monetary policy stance right now is removing accommodation. We've got about $20 billion in national debt. It's climbed tremendously over the past two administrations. So he kind of puts the backdrop for where things are at for this president. And it's going to be an uphill battle compared to, yes, Obama inherited a recession, but it's a lot easier to come out of a recession and have a good stock market, to have, you know, good growth, as all of the essentially catalysts are there to help propel it. We had fiscal stimulus, monetary stimulus, and now Trump wants to do fiscal stimulus, and we've been in a bull market for, you know, a good long period of time. Valuations are already stretched. This is the kind of stuff that Janet Yellen was talking about being leery of such a huge move, because it's likely going to have a large effect on inflation. So yeah, Jim's article, great read, and not too large. Jim is known for writing War and Peace on financial topics, because he does so much research. He really does. He's got a great bank of knowledge just based on how many books he reads on a regular basis. But yeah, short read, about 5 minutes, and all the meat's there. And then the other one, just to mention, since you talked about articles, Barron's, Their roundtable was released in their recent release of their subscription. And I think you can also actually get it online for free. I looked on Friday and I saw it online, maybe for a short term, it's available. But I definitely recommend any of our listeners check in on those two articles. Barron's Roundtable, a lot of high-level thinkers and managers of billions with a lot of wise and sage comments to make on this market, you know, regarding the stocks, bonds, rates, monetary policy, Trump, the fiscal policy. Great, great two reads. So definitely, if you're looking for a weekend article, check out Jim's article and Barron's Roundtable. That should do the trick.
There's another article, too, by the way. National Public Radio published one, and it's called The America Donald Trump is Inheriting by the Numbers. It was written by Danielle Kortzleben, and it's very, very good. She takes a whole series of indicators and just lays them side by side, you know, the beginning of Obama administration, the end of the administration, and where it's going. And next week, you know, I think the thing that we can look forward to, we're just waiting for it, elections 2018. Can't you wait? All right, Ryan Poplava, thanks much. Have a good weekend.
No problem at all. Good to talk to you, John. I'll talk to you next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Martin Armstrong of Armstrong Economics joins us today. He's the creator of the popular economic confidence model, sometimes referred to as the PI cycle, and it's received considerable attention over the years by accurately predicting major economic events well in advance. Martin, many people think that the stock market moves in a random, unpredictable fashion and that making forecasts is just a waste of time. However, you have made an astonishing number of successful forecasts over the years, and there was even a documentary made about you discussing some of these things. Before we get into some of your current forecasts and your outlook on the market, would you mind telling our audience about some of the major calls and events that you've predicted in the past?
Perhaps the first thing I should say is that I'm more of an international advisor, so we've had like offices around the world, and that has shown me that everybody acts out of their own self-interest. So like in the 80s, I was over in our office in Geneva, and everybody was dealing with OPEC money, et cetera. And then gradually, as the Japanese became basically the primary movers in capital markets, the money moved that way, but so did the talent. So everybody, the top brokers, et cetera, I knew in Geneva, then they were in Tokyo. After Tokyo, then they moved to Southeast Asia. So capital moves, and the computer basically follows the capital flows. And in doing so, it's very easy to see how money's going to move. For example, in 1985, the dollar went up to record highs, the pound went to virtually par, and politicians don't understand even what they're doing or trade. So you had Volcker trying to stop inflation. He raises interest rates up to like 17%. And then you're going to have people coming from all over the world buying 30-year bonds and collecting, you know, 17, 20%. And how is this going to change anything? So they don't really understand how to manage the economy. Then the dollar goes up. The dollar goes up so much that you then create the G5 in 1985 to try and manipulate the dollar down, all for trade. And here we are back again with Trump and trade and all these things. And most of it is currency driven.
Well, the stock market has been on a tear since the election. The market itself, reflected by the Dow, it's hard to believe the last summer we were down to 16,000 or earlier in the year. And we ended up the year close to 20,000, but we seem to have trouble. Will it go higher Or have we hit a ceiling? Joining us on the program is Tom McClellan. Tom, let's talk about this 20,000 ceiling that we've seen on the Dow. The market has been on a tear, so to speak, since the election of Donald Trump. And we moved up very quickly, but every single time we get up to that 20,000 level, as we almost did, correct me if I'm wrong, but a couple of Fridays ago, we got within a point or two intraday. What is it about 20,000?
It got within 37 cents of a point, and everybody froze and watched and waited. Is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? And like a deer in the headlights, and then it didn't happen. People are funny about these big round numbers.
What is it about round numbers? I don't care if it's, you know, 16,000, Dow 10,000, now we're dealing with 20,000. What is it that the market has trouble with even numbers or big numbers like that?
Well, it's the human brain. Remember Y2K was a big deal? You know, it's just another number. And it wasn't even, people said it's been 2,000 years since Jesus' birth, but actually it's only been 1999 years. But people are just funny about big round numbers. I remember as a kid, we would all get excited when my dad would say, the car's odometer's about to grow over 60,000. We'd all sit there and watch the numbers click through because we're just fascinated by big round numbers. It's part of the human condition.
So as you look at this market, which took a lot of people by surprise, in fact, Byron Wayne was recently interviewed in Barron's, and he said his forecast for last year were looking pretty good until the election of Donald Trump. And I think all of us will remember, Tom, election eve when the Dow futures was down 800 points, started down the next day and just took off like a rocket ship. As you look at the market now, given what it's doing and the difficulty it has had getting through that 20,000, is this a temporary pause from the way you read the charts, or are we have significant resistance here?
All that together. I do remember that election eve, and I commented at the time that, you know, when we had the surprise news of the Brexit vote, it took 2 days for the market to sort it out. But the U.S. is so much more efficient and productive. We can get 2 days worth of work done in one overnight session. What I do see happening is another push higher. We'll probably get through 20,000 and everybody will be relieved, and then we can start heading down in February and March. What generally happens when you have a new president come in, especially from a different party than the one before, is that everyone attaches all sorts of hope to the new guy. He's going to solve whatever problems that they can imagine might exist, and he's going to get it done real quickly, and it's all going to be a great panacea. And so that's been part of the hope that's lifted the stock market after the election. Plus, it was just relief of knowing. Market doesn't like an unknown risk, and it was a very tight election and tight polls leading up to it. And so that creates a lot of anxiety because people didn't know. And so once you give them the answer, then they do know, and then they can get back to life and investing and buying and selling, and it's all just fine. But when you have a new president, he gets inaugurated, and that hope about him fixing everything tends to reach a climax right about inauguration day. And then a week later, when he's been in office for an entire week and he hasn't solved all the problems, and then people get disappointed and they start muttering to themselves again. And some of that hope that lifted the market into inauguration will start going away. We've seen this happen every time. It doesn't really have anything to do at all with what the new president does or doesn't do. It has to do with the cycles of human emotion.
Yeah, because one thing that we do know, whether it's going to be repeal of Obamacare, whether it's going to be corporate or, let's say, individual tax cuts, it's going to be deregulation, all those things, Tom, as you and I well know, take time to work their way through the sausage factory we call Washington, D.C.
You can't make sausage right away, can you?
No, it takes time to make that sausage. So the markets, at least in my opinion, have gotten ahead of themselves. But as you look at the charts in, let's say, a longer term perspective, taking a look at where we've been, where it's going, do things look bullish to you longer term, despite the fact we may get, let's say, a correction here?
Well, one thing that looks very bullish is that even though the Dow is stalling at 20,000 or just underneath that ceiling, the New York Stock Exchange advanced decline line has continued to make slightly higher highs. And so that's a bullish divergence, meaning the advanced decline data are stronger than the price data. That's a good thing, and it tells you that whatever problems the market may have, liquidity is not one of them. There's enough liquidity to lift the majority of stocks. If you have a bearish divergence with prices making a higher high and the advanced decline making a lower high, that's big time to worry. And we had that indication way back in 2007, if you can remember all the way back then. And it was a bad message, and it got fulfilled. Right now, we have the opposite condition. Liquidity is plentiful. Now, that doesn't mean the market can't get rocked by other forces. But when you have strong liquidity, the market can get over whatever those other types of problems are much more quickly.
So when you take a look at this, let's also look at a perspective of the first year of a presidential term. Typically, most presidents like to get the bad stuff out of the way so that, you know, 2 or 3 years down the road when they're up for reelection, hopefully they get reelected. What I find rather interesting, and I'd love to get your take on this, is unlike his predecessors, Obama and Bush and those that went before, he's entering office with an aging business cycle, and he's also entering office with a tightening monetary cycle, where if you take a look at Bush, he entered office with a recession. The Fed started to loosen interest rates with Greenspan. You take a look at Obama, he enters office with the recession. Bernanke was lowering interest rates and began quantitative easing. Trump enters office with a different macro environment. Our first year terms a little bit more difficult for markets generally as you look at this historically?
Yeah, very much so. You're on the right track, exactly. And what they typically do, as you said, is try to get all the stuff fixed in the first year or two. Then they can spend year three and four declaring victory and saying you should vote for me again. That they don't tend to do that as much in a second term because there's no motivation for declaring victory in the second term because you're term limited out. But for as long as I've been alive and watching news and politics, when a new president comes in, they all seem to do this. Once they get inaugurated and they're in office for a while, they discover that, oh my gosh, things are even worse than I told you they were during the campaign, and that the only solution is thus and such, whatever proposal they have in mind. With Clinton, when he came into office in 1993, he declared it was the worst recession in 50 years, even though we had 5% GDP growth. And to him, the only solution was a $20 billion package of pork spending he wanted to get through Congress so he could reward his campaign contributors. Congress widely said no, but $20 billion is such a cute little number now. Bush came into office in 2001 and saw a recession, and he said the only solution was tax cuts. And so we had one round in 2001, another in 2003. Obama came into office, and the only solution was we needed to have $800 billion worth of spending on shovel-ready products. $800 billion will make you look back at $20 billion as a cute little number. So I don't know what it is that Mr. Trump is going to discover is worse than he told us before, and that the only solution is whatever he's got in mind. I don't know what that's going to be, but that's a typical thing to hear from presidents when they first take office. And it's a typical reaction of the market to think negatively of that. People don't like hearing that things are worse off than we told you before, and they tend to push down stock prices upon hearing that news. So just be ready for that and understand it for what it is when you see it.
All right, I want to move into another sector of the market. Let's talk about interest rates. We hit a low in the summer of last year. In fact, a historical low in terms of recorded human history. Since then, when we got down to almost 1.3, towards the end of the year, we got up to almost 2.6. As you look at interest rates, they've backed off recently. We're now in the 2.3 range. What does interest rates look like going forward? Because obviously, if the president wants to stimulate the economy, whether it's infrastructure spending, tax cuts, and the Federal Reserve is saying, no, we're raising interest rates. It's interesting. They were calling for infrastructure spending, and an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday said all of a sudden the Fed has flip-flopped and said, nope, we don't need any infrastructure or fiscal spending. As you look at interest rates, could this become a problem? And what do you see there?
Well, let's start from the humongous macro view of interest rates, which is that there is a 60-year cycle in interest rates, which should have seen a bottom for rates in 2010 as the 30-year point from when we had the peak in rates back in 1980. So the next peak in rates for the really, really long term is due in roughly 2040. And this 60-year cycle has been going on since interest rates first started being tabulated back in the 1700s, according to the data gathered by the Foundation for the Study of Cycles many years ago. So it's a real effect. And the work that I've done is tied that to climate. Basically, warmer temperatures are good for lower interest rates. Colder temperatures tend to bring higher interest rates because colder temperatures bring more inflation. Cold is bad for farm and food productivity, and that tends to lead to higher food prices, which tends to flow through to higher prices for everything else, and then that eventually flows through into interest rates. So we're supposed to be entering into a cooling period because that same 60 to 70 year cycle that shows up in interest rates has been known about by climate scientists for many years. It's just the only thing is that climate scientists and economists don't talk to each other. So most climate scientists are not aware that the same 60 year cycle also exists in interest rates. We're supposed to be in a cooling cycle lasting from now until around 2040, which should be bringing us a higher interest rate cycle. But so far, the Earth has refused to cool off like it's supposed to, according to these cycles. And that's been a good thing. That's helped keep farm productivity worldwide at a high level, to help keep interest rates fairly low and inflation rates fairly low. You have a little bit of an effect from oil prices and what OPEC's doing, changing the calculation a little bit, but we're still at really low, low inflation rates for a guy who grew up in the markets in the 1980s, and I remember 17% inflation rates and interest rates. So this is really low, and it's likely to stay low for several more years. We can see fluctuations in interest rates all the time because in any cycle of any length, including 60 years, you're going to see noise in the pattern. Some of that noise can be tradable for us looking at a daily basis, but I don't expect a return to 7 or 10% inflation and interest rates for quite a long time.
If you and I were having this conversation, it's December 31st of this year, would you see interest rates higher, lower, or about the same in terms of where they are now?
I think it's going to be violently sideways. Is that a good enough description?
Sure.
But I don't think that we're going to see a huge uptrend in interest rates. And right now, looking at sentiment conditions for bonds, one of the best indicators of that is the commitment of traders data. We're seeing that the smart money traders, meaning the commercial guys, the big money, they are net long T-bonds in a huge way, both the 20-year and the 10-year. It just absolutely haven't seen this for years. They're making a huge bet, and these guys end up being right most of the time. And in the long run, especially when they get to a humongously skewed view like they're showing us right now. So I'm expecting that bond prices are going to go higher, meaning rates lower in the next few months, probably as people start looking at Trump not solving all the problems and the economy really slowing down and we're going to encounter problems we weren't thinking about last year. That'll probably flow through into thinking toward interest rates being more attractive than people have been thinking that they have been.
Let's move on to another area, which is the dollar, which is, you know, hit a 14-year high. It has also risen since the election of Donald Trump. We know, Tom, if, you know, most of the companies that make up the S&P 500, those companies that make up the Dow, they're international companies. A rising dollar hurts the profits of corporations. What about the dollar? Does it head higher?
Everybody seems to think so. And so I tend to think the opposite. The rise in the dollar has been great if you're an American tourist going to Mexico, especially because it's really hurt them. The sentiment of everybody thinking the dollar going higher seems to be so universal that it can't possibly live up to that. Your point about international corporations being hurt by a strong dollar, that's partly true, but the pain is unevenly distributed. If you're Coke or Pepsi, you have a huge hedging operation, which wipes away most of that effect. If you're a smaller company, you can't afford to hire all the traders and engage in all the hedging that the gigantic companies can, and so it hurts them more. And so you have a differential effect depending on the size of the company and what abilities that they have to throw off that sort of risk.
It's interesting because as you take a look at market strategists, as they make their recommendations for the new year, where to invest, everybody's been recommending small cap stocks because they would tend to benefit more from a Trump presidency, emphasizing domestic issues versus international. As you look at the indexes from the Dow, the S&P, the Russell, the larger and smaller cap indexes, how do you see things faring? In other words, if you look at the Russell 2000 and compare that to the S&P and Dow, which looks better?
Well, looking backward, the Russell 2000 looks great. It's had a huge run, and it's been mostly by the small cap value stocks. The Russell 2000 is broken into growth and value, and there's a lot of financial companies in the value sector, and they've been leading the way because the financial sector overall has been doing well. We all know about Goldman Sachs contributing 300 points to the Dow's 1,500-point run since the election. So that same story has flowed through into the small caps. Using the same principle about the dollar, small caps have much more potential to be helped by deregulation than the large caps do, because the small cap company doesn't have the money to hire lobbyists and get special legislation that a large cap company can create for itself in Congress to get special favors to advantage it. Large companies also have big administrative offices that can handle all the burdens of regulation, where smaller companies, it's much harder for them to grapple with that and find their way around it. So if you're going to be in a environment with a lessening of onerous federal regulations, then a small company has much more upside to benefit from that, because they're being hurt by that much more now. So that's been a lot of the thinking that has been going into investors piling into small caps after the Trump victory. Whether that thinking is actually true or not will matter someday, but it doesn't matter in the immediate moment when they're all doing the buying.
Let's look at another sector, and that's commodities. We've seen gold plummet on the election. Now it's recently in a rise as the dollar has softened. What's your view on gold and oil prices?
Gold has started a new 13.5-month cycle. It started the upward phase with that bottom that we saw late last year. That bottom arrived about a month later than it was ideally supposed to, which is kind of frustrating when you're waiting for a bottom to come in and it shows up a month late. But being a plus or minus a month from the ideal date is actually fairly typical for that long cycle. The advancing phase of a new 13.5-month cycle is a very robust, wonderful period for gold, and I expect that to continue, although I expect just over the next few days we might see a little bit of a soft spot, just because it's had such a nice run for the last 3 weeks. Oil prices, I'm not very bullish on. We're starting to hear Wall Street firms all looking toward higher objectives, none of them looking lower, and that's a big tell. And at the same time, in the commitment of traders data, we're seeing the commercial traders of oil futures are holding a huge net short position, about equivalent to what they were holding at 2014, right before OPEC turned open the spigots and let prices flow downward. So I think that the people all expecting $80 to $90 oil prices again are going to get disappointed, and the path of least resistance from here is downward. So I'm not very bullish on oil at all.
Going back to gold, does gold break out and hit higher highs this year, or do we have resistance problems going forward?
Well, it should go higher than where it is now. How far it goes is much less important than the direction it's traveling. And so I tend not to worry too much about figuring out how far it's going to go ahead of time. I just try to get the direction right and ride it for as long as it's going and look for the signs that that trend direction is ending. And we're not seeing those yet. It seems to be just getting started on the uptrend.
And finally, as we take a look at, we've seemed to hit stall speed here as we've headed closer to 20,000 on the Dow and also on the S&P. Tom, do you think what we're seeing right now is it's going to be a minor correction and then we move forward, a major correction? In other words, if you had to put money to work right now, what would you be doing?
Well, I do have money put to work right now. We sub-advise a managed accounts program that's 150% long the S&P right now. I'm expecting to lighten that up next week, and I'm expecting to be actively shorting the market after about February 9th. As we go through about a two-month correction, but then I expect the market to rebound from that two-month correction and trend higher for much of the rest of the year.
Well, listen, Tom, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you do, how could they do so, please?
Well, you can find me pretty easily. Just Google Tom McClellan. You can get directly to our website, which is mcoscillator.com. That's a contraction of McClellan Oscillator, the indicator that my parents developed back in 1969. On that website, you can find out about our newsletters. You can sign up for a free two-week trial. You can even sign up for a free weekly chart and focus series. It's an article about technical analysis. It comes out once a week. It's a great opportunity, no strings attached. We won't spam you. We won't bother you with marketing. It's just a way to get more people acquainted with the work that we do.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Axel Merck, President and CIO of Merck Investments, joins us today. And Axel, I want to go off your 2017 outlook. It was a webinar that you just did. You had a number of really fascinating and very good points that you made, insights, some of the research that you did. One point in particular that I really thought was important for investors to understand, and obviously you put a lot of research into this, is you did analysis on the potential impacts of rising yields in the U.S. And as many of our listeners know, we did see see a major bottom in yields last year. I believe it was in the June timeframe, mid last year. And yields have been picking up in the U.S. since then. So now the question is, if we're going to see yields continue to increase, and that is to see the bond market, that is price of bonds fall as yields rise, what are the potential impacts? And I know you looked at the various S&P 500 sectors, and you also looked at different asset classes. So would you mind telling us, why did you conduct this analysis and what were the key results?
Well, sure. Great to be with you. Well, first, in order to know where one is heading towards, it's always good to understand where one is coming from. And that might sound like a simple statement, but basically what we did is we ran a bunch of correlations of how markets have been acting in 2016, in the 12 months prior to doing this analysis. And assuming the markets will act in exactly the same fashion, this sort of thing would happen if yields were to rise. And I give that as a caveat because, of course, markets will not act in the same way. But it is very good to understand where the market is coming from. And then one can, of course, have an interpretation, oh, I disagree with this and so forth. And then obviously, what is priced in already is going to change. So specifically, not too surprisingly, one of the things that might happen if U.S. Treasury yields were to rise further based on this analysis is that utility companies would be the worst performers. Usually, they have a lot of debt levels and higher rates will tend to be negative for them. At the other end of the spectrum would be financials. Financials benefit from the bigger yield spreads, from higher rates that they can collect when they lend at the long end and so forth. And so that sort of analysis has kind of given us a kind of an overview of how the different types of sectors might be performing. And then, of course, you can take it the next step. Well, is all of this good news priced in already? Now, what is interesting is that at least as far as last year was concerned, the one fixed income sector that actually benefited from a rise in yields was a European bond aggregate. And you might want to scratch your head of why exactly would that do so well. But the one thing to keep in mind is also that we've had a stock market environment that was generally moving up. And so a lot of the higher yield sectors, the sectors that would historically be more associated with being correlated to equities, risk on assets, so to speak, well, they performed well. That doesn't mean going forward, as treasury yields move higher, that they will continue to do well. And then we also did the analysis on commodities and foreign exchange. It turns out that gold had a very high correlation to rising yields. That doesn't mean gold is going to do well. It turns out, though, that both gold and the yen were the worst performers. So that suggests that in a rising yield environment, gold would underperform. Now, gold is obviously dear to your audience, our audience as well. And so we're wondering, well, does it mean you should sell your gold? And indeed, a lot of folks that had gotten out of gold end of last year, by the way, earlier this year, some of them have come back in. And this really then comes down to the question, are yields rising because real interest rates are rising or because inflation is moving up? And as many of you remember, towards the end of last year, the markets was pricing in that we're going to have this grand new world where everything is going to be perfect, real rates are going to move up, and looked at all the positives that would happen from this new administration. And the question is, and I'll pause here to let you ask a question, well, maybe some of these other factors might be driving in. And if you look at gold in recent days, at least, it appears that not everything is going to be positive as far as real rate growth is concerned with regard to the markets. And so I do think there might be a place for gold amongst others.
Well, for consumers, the price of gasoline has been going up. The price of oil, after being stuck in a $40 to $50 range, is now above $50, and some say it could go even higher. Joining us on the program is Dan Steffens. And Dan, let's talk about oil and the OPEC meeting. Let's begin with that. Nobody thought they would be able to pull it off or even get the Russians to go along, but it seems to bring that whole group together, realizing that everybody producing as much oil as they could wasn't getting them anywhere. They were running huge deficits. The price was kept low. And you had the Saudis tapping the debt market. So is this production cut real? And could we see additional production cuts if American shale production heats up?
Yeah, right off the bat, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait have already announced that they're willing to cut production even more than what they agreed to just to get this thing kicked off. And then I think they're going to put pressure on the other OPEC members to, as quickly as possible, get to their quotas. So, yes, I think the production cuts are real. Will there be some cheating? Yes. But, you know, one thing helping this is that all these countries were already producing max out. And you've got people like Venezuela that their production is on decline anyway just because they can't pay their bills. I mean, Schlumberger's pulled out of the country. So you've got Venezuelan production on steep decline. Iran's probably maxed out without additional billions of investment in their country. And now with Trump the president, who knows what's going to happen with the Iranian, you know, nuke deal. So, I don't think you can expect them to cheat that much because they're already there, you know. And, I think they're going to adhere to it. And my view is that if you combine the OPEC cuts with what the Russians and some others said they were going to cut, you're at 1.8 million barrels a day. I think if they cut 1.2 million barrels a day combined, we get to $60 oil within 6 months. If they would go to the top end of what their quotas are, I think you could be looking at 65, 70 in maybe 9 to 12 months by the end of the year.
You know, that's interesting because one of the things that we've seen is the Fed talk about inflation. In inflation, their numbers, they're talking about a 2% rate. And if oil prices go up, that's going to contribute to that. And the Fed's talking about raising interest rates. And we all know about these guys. It's not a precise science. They keep raising until they break something.
Mm-hmm.
So would that be a risk?
Well, I think the one risk that I see is that the U.S. dollar just keeps getting stronger. Crude oil is traded all over the world in U.S. dollars. And if you'd go to the U.S. dollar index, you can just Google it and go to that. You'll see that the U.S. dollar compared to other currencies has really spiked since the Fed announced they were going to go on this, you know, tightening deal. And then also because with the Trump election, they believe that the U.S. economy will really get into higher gear. And so the U.S. dollar is strengthened. Well, as the U.S. dollar goes up, oil prices go down. It puts pressure on oil price. So that's actually one of my fears that could cap oil prices. I mean, if the U.S. dollar was back to where it was pre-election, you would probably be pushing $60 oil today. The dollar is up 7 or 8%. So if you took 7 or 8% off of that, you could add even more, like 10% to the oil price. And so you'd be up, you know, near 57, 58 or something right now. The global oil market is pretty much in balance now. It's just that we have to work off a lot of excess inventory. So,
yeah, I was going to ask you that, too, because during that period of time when we saw that glut of oil, we saw it took a while for production to shut down here in the U.S. We heard about oil being stored in all the major storage facilities across the country. Then we also heard that they were storing it on tankers and using that within the futures market for arbitrage. What about all that? How much excess is there, and how long do you think it's going to take for that to work its way down?
Well, right now we have about 80 to 100 million barrels in U.S. storage above normal. The normal level is about 400 million barrels. I mean, the refiners, they want to keep about 30 days of supply in inventory. I mean, if you run a refinery, crude oil is your feedstock. And so you don't want to run short because if you ever have to, you know, shut down a refinery, it's very expensive to shut it down and very expensive to start it up. So you want it to run smoothly, so you have to have, you know, inventory. I mean, I would argue that the new normal is higher than where it was 5 years ago because there's very little excess capacity in the world. And one thing that we can be sure of is that eventually something unexpected will happen in the crude oil supply demand market. I mean, the Middle East is still, you know, a quagmire of countries that could easily go to war with each other any day. You've got, supply chains that could be broken any time. And it only takes a small shortage to cause a big spike in price. And so I would think the refiners would want to keep much higher level in storage. I mean, we're still, the U.S. refiners are still very dependent on importing oil. I mean, we're still importing about 8 million barrels a day or more. I've seen spikes up to 10 million barrels a day some weeks, so we're still very dependent on imports.
Well, that was, the idea that it just doesn't take one event for the markets to spike. We saw that, I believe, last year in the Canadian oil sands when there was a fire that shut a million barrels offline, and voila, we went from 40 to over 50 just like overnight.
Yeah, I mean, you could have food riots or something in Venezuela. I mean, right now they have food shortages in country. You have something down there that overthrows the government or something like that. I mean, we're dependent on, there's like 2 million barrels a day coming out of Venezuela. What if half of that was cut off for any reason? You know, Libya, Nigeria, Angola, all these places are, you know, they have issues with their population, so anything can happen. The one thing that you can expect is that the unexpected will happen in the oil market.
Well, that's our theme for 2017, expect the unexpected. So, you know, maybe that's where it comes from. I want to talk about something else, and that is the Trump administration is vowing that they're going to free up energy production. They're going to get rid of some of the regulations, maybe some of the restrictions, lift some of the bans on offshore drilling. What effect do you think that will have on energy production?
No, it would be great for the industry. I mean, I can tell you people in Oklahoma and Texas are pretty excited about it. Just, you know, lowering, you know, some regulations and you know, even stuff like Obamacare, lowering all the reporting requirements and stuff will lower their back office cost. But the biggest thing could happen if he lowers corporate tax rates. I mean, I've heard talk of lowering them to 15 or 20%. That would be huge, not just for the oil and gas industry, everything, and help the whole economy. And if the economy picks up, if a lot of manufacturing comes back, well, manufacturing needs more energy and needs more feedstock. And so that helps the whole food chain of oil and gas. And I mean, they're pretty excited. Actually, we had a luncheon in Houston yesterday, and the former chairman of the Texas Railroad Commission was our speaker. And he reminded us that almost a third of the active oil rigs in the world are drilling in Texas and Oklahoma right now. And if you add in the little corner of southeastern New Mexico that's part of the Permian Basin, think about it, that's about a third of the active rigs in the world are in this region right here around Houston and Dallas. So,
who would have thought 7-8 years ago that the U.S. would be the most significant factor in the energy market when you talk about increased oil production going from what we were producing, 5 million barrels, and we went to over 9 million barrels. I wanted to stay in that area. Let's talk about the Permian Basin. Recently, we saw ExxonMobil make a, what, $5 or $6 billion purchase. What's going on in the Permian Basin, and is that really our new source of oil in this country?
Yeah, that Exxon Bass deal was pretty stunning, I can tell you, when I saw that this week. It's like $6.5 billion, a billion in cash and the rest in ExxonMobil stock to the Bass family. But that is the last of a whole series of multi-billion dollar acquisitions out there. The thing is, in the Permian, it is stacked pays. There's 8 or 9 productive zones out there. And so there's almost impossible to drill a dry hole anywhere. And these horizontal wells, especially in the Wolf Camp, is getting tremendous results. And these are really, they're not shale plays. They're just tight formations. And they're drilling up to 2 mile long horizontal wells. The lateral length is up to 2 miles. And they are fracking the heck out of these things, opening up the pore space and getting tremendous wells. Now, a fear that I hear is that, you know, all U.S. production will pick up and that'll flood the market and everything. Well, the one thing investors need to remember is the oil field services sector has been devastated. The people, 100,000 people have lost their jobs. Equipment's been idled. You know, you let these rigs and fracking equipment sit out in the weather for 2 years and, you know, they're not ready to go back in the field without a lot of repairs. So, in fact, they've scrapped our ravaged a bunch of the rigs just for parts for the current one. So, you know, we can maybe bring another 100 rigs back to work. The highest estimate that I've seen for U.S. production increasing this year is 500,000 barrels a day. So just compare that to like what OPEC's cutting, and then also the fact that demand for oil-based products goes up by over 1 million barrels a year. And you can see that the U.S. increase in production isn't going to have a big impact on supply and demand. We're still going to be very tight supply and demand by the end of this year.
So where's the big profit opportunities? I mean, you know, one of the things that you saw when oil dropped from $100 a barrel and it got down to, what was it, $26 a barrel, the big integrated oil companies, your Exxons, your Chevrons, they went down, but they went down the least. A lot of these smaller companies, a lot of these stocks were down 60, 70%. Now that production is increasing, now that demand is up and the price is rising, it would seem to me that the place to be would be in those companies that have the ability to increase production. It's the same thing that we're running in a slow growth economy. Those companies that can increase sales, like your Netflix, your Amazons, are the stocks that are commanding premiums in the marketplace. Is it the same in the energy industry?
Yeah, exactly. My focus is on finding companies that have double-digit production and proven reserve growth locked in. If you invest in upstream companies, by upstream, I mean, these are the producers, the guys that go out and drill the wells, complete the wells. They're the ones that bring the oil and gas out of the ground. The people that can do that within cash flow, those are the ones, those stocks are going to be going up. And, you know, some of the newer players is like Diamondback Energy, their symbol's FANG, F-A-N-G. Now, that stock's already trading at a pretty high multiple, but you look at Pioneer Natural Resources, PXD. One I really like out there is Concho Resources, CXO. Another area that's not getting as much headlines as the Permian is what's going on up in Oklahoma. This scoop stack play up there, again, you have stacked formation. There's really five really good zones, and then there in some areas there are up to seven or eight zones that are productive. It's what used to be kind of called the Anadarko Basin. It's just west of Oklahoma City, and there's two new plays. It's Scoop was the term Scoop was invented by Continental Resources, and they have most of that one. And then Stack, that name was given to it by Newfield Exploration. But there's really only five big publicly traded companies up there: Devon, Continental, Newfield, Cimarex, and recently Marathon bought big into there. But those five companies own, you know, 75 or 80% of the really good acreage, and you got a lot of small private companies up in there. But the well level economics up there are just as good, if not better, than the Permian. You just don't hear as much about it because there hadn't been as much of this M&A activity that gets all the big headlines on Wall Street. So that's a place where I think people ought to be looking.
Well, let's talk about what is going on in the energy industry itself. And one thing that you and I have spoken about in the past, with the drop in oil prices, you know, an oil company produces oil, and it's kind of like a warehouse. You got barrels of oil going out the front door. You better drill or find more oil to replace that warehouse. We thought that perhaps with lower prices, and especially with some of these smaller companies that had good shale plays, that they'd get picked up in terms of acquisitions. We haven't seen too much on that. Now we have Exxon spending, what, $5 or $6 billion on a Permian Basin play with the Bass Brothers. Do you expect to see more of that now that oil's picking up?
Yeah, the big deals that have been announced have really been public companies buying private companies, buying some of these venture capital-backed private companies that had acquired a bunch of acreage out there. Yeah, there could be a lot of M&A activity with public companies. The big one that was announced the other day was Clayton Williams, and also Sanchez bought Anadarko out of the Eagle Ford for about $2 billion. That was a pretty big deal. So yeah, there's players moving pieces around. I mean, these deals don't increase production because it was already producing or somebody else. They just, you know, move the assets around. But big numbers, I mean, everything's the billions now. You know, we went above the 100 millions. We went to the billions pretty quickly.
Yeah, because what do you do when you're Exxon, Chevron? How do you replace reserves? Because you certainly aren't making major discoveries. And it seems like one of the easiest ways, one of the advantages of being a large integrated company, you have a strong balance sheet and you have cash flow. And that gives you the means to do what Exxon just did, you know, $1 billion in cash to the Bass family and about another $5 billion in Exxon stock.
Well, for the big companies like ExxonMobil, the one thing that's attractive about the Permian is, yeah, it adds a lot of proven reserves. You have one well can drill through all these zones. They log all those zones, and they get to add those to their proven reserve base. And their reserves per section out there are pretty substantial. I mean, millions and millions of barrels per section that they're being able to add to their reserve base. And yeah, that's important for all these publicly traded companies. They have to continually be replacing reserves that they produce. And, you know, once the reserves start going down, usually the stock price starts going down. So they're the CEOs of those companies are very aware of what they need to do.
You know, it was rather interesting, Dan. I was looking at forecasts for the S&P this year, the Dow companies, and especially the S&P companies. And I was looking at analyst estimates, and I was looking at them, and I thought, boy, these are really big increases in earnings. And I'm looking at the economy and companies in general, and I just didn't see it. But the main reason analysts are increasing earnings for the S&P is the comeback in the energy industry, just as it had a major impact with losses that these companies were seeing as the price oil went from 100 all the way down to into the 20s. It's having the reverse effect now that the price of oil has doubled in the last year, that a lot of these companies at, you know, over $50 oil, they're making money again.
Oh, yeah. And the cash flow is actually pretty strong at these prices. Yeah, some of these wells, even at $50 oil, are going to pay out in less than a year. And then produce for quite a while. The one thing, the more we produce from these tight formations, the shales and just the tight sands and everything, we are creating a treadmill. We become more and more dependent on these tight oil plays because they have steep decline curves. They don't decline by 5 or 6% per year. They decline maybe by 60 or 70% the first 2 years. I mean, they come on strong, but you go from a 1,500 barrel a day well to a 750 barrel a day well, you know, within a year, and then cut it in half again by the second year. And then they kind of level off because they frack them so hard and they bring them on really strong. And that's great from an economic standpoint because you get the investment back, you get your capital back, and then you're just building this tail of proven reserves because the wells themselves will be economic and produce for 15 or 20 years, but not at those real high rates that they come on as. So you're constantly, you know, having to replace those high rate wells that are falling off from that you drilled in the last couple of years. You have to keep drilling more and more wells, which is good for the service company. So, you know, from your investor standpoint, think about the Schlumbergers and the Halliburtons of the world that they do all those frack jobs and everything. And I will tell you, take a hard look at the frack sand companies. I think the demand for frack sand, if we're right about these prices and oil goes to 60 and gas goes to 350 or 4, we are talking about big increase in frac sand demand between last year and this year.
You know, as you look at this, as we conclude here, so we have a lot of things that are going, or let's say in the positive camp for energy. You've got OPEC cutting and indicating that they're willing to cut more to keep the prices up there. You have a Trump administration coming in that is going to do a couple things, cut corporate taxes. They're talking about freeing regulations, especially at the EPA level, and making it easier to produce energy. So those things are positive. And we also have demand growth growing. We actually have economic growth picking up in Germany and Europe. If the U.S. economy picks up and economic growth and manufacturing comes here, you know, we've seen a number of companies that the president-elect has been able to keep their factories here. I don't care if you're talking about Ford to Carrier. They're saying, okay, we're going to build factories here or keep them here. That's going to increase demand for energy. So that's all on the positive side. On the negative side, you have the Federal Reserve raising interest rates, which has been producing or has caused the dollar to rise to a 14-year high. So outside of, let's say, the dollar, do you see anything else negative that could impact the energy industry?
Well, I mean, you could always have like a real problem with the European economy or something. You know, this Brexit thing, who knows how that's really going to affect the Eurozone. So, I mean, that could lower energy demand, but, you know, you never know. Right now, I see the risk more to the upside for energy prices than I do for the downside. One thing that doesn't get talked about all that much is how much the demand for natural gas liquids, NGLs, is going to go up this year. There's a lot of, with manufacturing increasing, one of the main feedstocks for a lot of manufacturers is hydrocarbon-based liquids. You know, this is the NGLs that go into all the plastics and all the stuff on your cell phone and everything you see has got a lot of NGLs in it. And that demand is really going up because it cratered last year. I saw people selling NGLs for $10 a barrel. And now the prediction is that the basket of NGLs should go up to about 50% of WTI. So if West Texas Intermediate goes to 60 and NGLs could go to 30, you would see a substantial increase for a lot of these upstream companies in revenues. And that's something that's not being talked about all that much. I mean, we talk about it here in Houston, but not around the world. I don't think people quite understand that market, and they focus more on the oil price. But that could have an impact on, and that could, you know, have an impact on inflation, too, if it adds to, you know, product cost.
If we were having this conversation December 31st, we have got oil prices close to $52 a barrel. Your best guess, where we end the year?
My best guess is 60 and sometime in the second half. And if, like I said at the beginning, if OPEC does do the cuts, if they actually cut 1.8 million barrels a day, OPEC and the Russian group, I think we got a chance at 70 by the end of the year. And I think we got a real good chance of seeing natural gas moving up to $4 sometime before the end of the year. Because I think that natural gas market in the U.S. is really going to tighten up this year.
And finally, if you were to make an energy play this year, investing in the sector, you would be looking at companies that have the ability to increase their production. Their top line revenue growth would be the place to be. And also some of the, let's say, energy service companies.
Right. And then if your listeners are looking for yield, there's some really good buys in the midstream companies. And look at the really strong ones. These are the gatherers, processors, the people that store raw materials and crude oil and stuff, and also store refined products. That's a necessary business. It's kind of been pulled down by the whole dark cloud hanging over the industry. And there's some really good midstream companies that are paying dividends and 7, 8, 9% yield. They're just solid. I mean, they're almost like utility companies. So that's a good place to look for yield.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they can find out more about what you do.
Well, if they want to send an email to energyperspectus@gmail.com and just tell them they heard about us on your show, we will give them a special promo code where they can get $100 off their first year membership with us. It's normally $350 to be a member, and you get our newsletter. You get individual company profiles and recommendations. And I do a weekly podcast that updates everybody on what's going on in the oil and gas markets. So it's really a service for what I would call self-directed investors that want to do their own research and are looking for good ideas. So just send an email to energyperspectus@gmail.com.
Now, coming up next on The Big Picture is one of my more favoriter shows of every single year. Is that a word? No, my most favorite shows of every single year, where we have a two-part series. The first part is to look at the consensus projections for what's going to come in the current year, along with all of the outliers and people thinking outside the box. And then we do our own predictions, of course, this year factoring in the change of presidential administration and the economic conditions that Mr. Trump's presidency is going to confront. I promise you it will be interesting, as this show always is every single year, right here on the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.